Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello again, and I think we're still on this abundance thing, aren't we? Because it's a fascinating conversation.
It is, yes.
It is, absolutely. It's pivot point is about valuing yourself. And of course, we aren't taught to value ourselves. And sometimes spiritual people go a bit sort of, it's very selfish to value yourself. But unless you're a car full of petrol, you can't drive anyone anywhere.
That's so true. Yeah. My favourite version of that is you cannot offer out from an empty cup.
No, you absolutely can't. And I really started turning my life around with Louise Hay all those years ago after Henry died. And she has this affirmation, I love and approve of myself. Mm. I couldn't say that to start with. I managed to say I approve of myself, but it took me a long time to be able to say it into a mirror, which is one of the exercises you're meant to do. And I'm so grateful that I am there now. And even if something awful happens, like, you know, being diagnosed with cancer and all that, there's always a point of saying, I still love you, Maggie. You know, we may have screwed up somewhere here, but hey, you know, you've always done the best you could with the knowledge you've got. What's next?
Absolutely.
So I am very blessed. But a couple of things that when I was working in that pub in London, the Dartmouth Arms, it was called, and they just refurbished it and they were all new there. And I think it all went to hell in a handcart quite quickly, probably. But it was supposed to be a gourmet pub. And I was just literally peeling the vegetables for the chef. And then one Sunday morning, I was supposed to be going in peeling for prepared for Sunday lunch or something. And I was in at 8 o'clock in the morning and the chef didn't turn up.
Gosh.
17 breakfasts ordered. So I'm standing there in a pub and I had several possible lines of thought. One of which was, I'm not paid to cook breakfast, stuff you. And that's the poverty conscious one.
Oh.
Then I had the, I've directed live television, I can do this. Mm-hmm. If I've directed live television, there isn't an awful lot I can't do. And the third one was, what an adventure.
Yeah.
So I cooked all the breakfast. In fact, I cooked about 50 breakfasts that morning. And I would like to apologise. I do apologise. I'm very sorry. But some of the vegetarian ones probably weren't 100%.
Oh my God.
Because I was trying to deal with different frying pans. Mm-hmm. And there was one time I realised I cracked an egg into one where I cooked some bacon. And I thought, but I got six more to do, so I'm very sorry. It wasn't your fault, it was my fault. And I'm sure God won't punish you for that. But and at the end of it, I did even worse. At the end of that morning, they were delivering a new oven and they got it stuck up the stairs. So even after I'd finished the shift and the chef hadn't turned up because apparently he got a terrible hangover, I was trapped in that kitchen.
By a cooker.
And nobody else could get in, so then I had to cook lunch.
Oh my goodness.
And at the end of the day, I remember sitting on the floor. I'd had to pee in the sink and all the things like that. And I was sitting on the floor waiting for them to move this thing. And it was just going to sunset and there was one window. And I sat on the floor and all I could do was look out of the window. And I have to admit, at that point, I wept. Because, you know, for God's sake, I wasn't going to be paid anymore. I'd been there all Sunday. I couldn't get out or anything like that. And just grace came into my head, which was two men looked through the prison bars. One saw mud and the other saw stars. And then the sunset came and one tiny star. You know, and so people can sometimes say to me, well, you're so lucky. No, it's there. You've just got to look for it. And probably for me, the pivot point at that was, I did work too hard. I could have gone on strike, but I actually rather enjoyed it. But by the time I got miserable, I just sat there and gave up. And the star, the one star.
Can I just peel back round to...
Oh, God, yes.
I'm sure God won't punish you for that. Is that a thing? Does God punish people for
stuff? No, but we think he does, which is why we have to bring it up.
Right.
We do think that we get punished for doing bad things because we were punished as children. I was telling this story about my childhood the other day, and what you don't realise is that what happened to you is more traumatic than you remember it being sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things about the punishment is we were made wrong so often as children. We sort of blanked out to it.
Yeah.
We will say things like God punishes you, but we blanked out to the actual pain of it, so we don't give a good response to it. I was just telling people about, I mean, I got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. A lot of it was because it's your immune system turning against you, not being able to defend you, because I'd never felt defended. And I said, there's a story from my childhood that will illustrate that. And I was telling this on a Zoom call. And I just looked at the people's faces afterwards and their jaws had hit the ground.
Yeah.
And the story was that my mum was agoraphobic and the doctor used to come and visit her and I hated him. He was horrible. But I had to kiss him. Had to kiss Dr. Morton every time because that's what my mother wanted me to do because she meant she didn't have to, I think, probably.
Right.
But anyway, there was one time I ran away and I hid. I hid under my brother's bed, behind the shoes, behind the boxes, so I didn't have to get out, have to kiss Dr. Morton. I was searched for, found, dragged out and made to kiss Dr. Morton.
Bloody hell.
And they didn't know that was wrong. Dr. Yes. Morton and my mother did not know that was wrong. But that trained me as you have no right to boundaries.
Yeah.
You will be punished.
Your no is meaningless.
Yes, your no is meaningless. You will be punished for trying to assert your boundaries. And then you assume that that's God. Right. Because it's your parents. It's the authority. It's the authority, and you go. If you go to church, you've got usually a vicar. Sorry, mates, but you really don't know what you're doing a lot of the time, promulgating this rubbish about the judgmental God. And it's got to stop.
Yeah,
it's got to stop. You know, when nowadays when I talk to people from the older generation and they come out with casual racism or something, I realise it's still in me. Because this was trained into me, and I will still say something stupid sometimes, and I will try to be an ally, but I know I don't understand.
Yeah. Oh, I saw such a beautiful... Oh, yes! Yes! I think that's so lovely. Just for those who don't know what we're talking about, there are the backs of two hands, and they're doing a pinky swear. They've got their little fingers intertwined, and there's a...
Black and a white.
Yeah, well, it's a colour.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as black and white, is it?
No.
But across the knuckles is written, I know I will understand. I will never understand. But nevertheless,
I stand.
And that did to me what it's just doing to you.
If I can find it, I'll post it on the Podbean site.
Oh, do. Yeah. It's so wonderful.
Because it is, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've got a black friend from Belize in California who I met on Facebook who posts all the time about Black Lives Matter and what it's like. And he's taught me so much because I go along and go, Dan, I'm so sorry I've done that. I didn't know. I really had no idea I'd done that. Yeah. And I've told him stories about times when I have tried to stand up for things and when I failed. And we've got into so many conversations and it sounds really ridiculous. But you know, on Facebook, when it's your birthday, people come along and post on your HBD or spell your name wrong. But it's all very kind of them to bother. Yeah. And this guy came along and wrote, happy birthday and thank you for being such an ally.
Oh.
And that one made me cry.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying and I'm failing and I will never understand. I'll never understand what it's like to be born in poverty. I won't, because I wasn't.
Yeah.
But I do understand that there are ways through. And I will stand.
Yeah.
And I'll get it wrong.
Yeah. But all we can do is our best in the moment with what we've got in the moment.
Yeah.
And that's, I just think that's so incredibly important to remember.
And it's also so important with people. When I realised that the way Jesus healed was because he just saw the perfection in the person. And I've always been a bit of a wimp. I don't necessarily come across as a wimp, but inside I'm a heaving pile of, I just cover it up very well. But I found I wanted to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. I want to walk like St. Francis. I want to be an example of kindness wherever I can, but discrimination and discernment as well. Yeah. I don't mean negative discrimination, but discernment. And I tried it, and it is extraordinary. I learned it via Ho'oponopono, which is the Hawaiian, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you. And I had somebody was really angry about something. They weren't blaming me for it, but they needed to talk to me about it. And I put a hand out to ask if they wanted to put their hand into mine. Don't take somebody's hand, just offer.
Mm.
And they put my hand in mine, and I said, "You are so beautiful." And she was, because I was looking into her eyes at that point, and I could see this incredible beauty coming out through this rage.
Mm.
And it stopped her in her tracks. "What do you mean? What do you mean?" And I said, "But you're so lovely, you know. Keep talking, it's fine. I'm just loving you." And nobody had ever said anything like that to her before when she was angry.
Wow.
And I just thought, maybe this is one of the answers.
Mm.
It's just to sit and say, "Get it all out, love, and I'll just sit and love you while you do it."
Yeah.
And you can hate me.
Isn't that what is so extraordinary and such a beautiful thing about the ever-growing number of specifically, I'm talking about women's circles, but there are men's circles too, but I wouldn't pretend to know what happens in them. But exactly that, that we sit in a circle and with no judgment and the best amount of compassion we can muster, loving each other, we listen.
Yeah.
And that is such an extraordinarily healing experience for so many people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A thing of true beauty.
Yes, to be heard.
To be heard. Just in that space of, I'm not going to join you in your rage. I can't mend your rage for you. I can't fix you. I can't save you.
Yeah.
But I can sit here and deeply listen and love you.
Yes. Yeah. And I actually have to thank my mum, because by moving into this home and basically selling the house to pay for this home, it's encouraged me to be more me, oddly enough, because my brother and I have been the carers for her. Well, all her neighbours have been the carers for her. They've been amazing because I'm miles away. But it's enhanced the relationship with my brother. And I've been talking about my life with them, in my brother, his wife and my cousin, in ways that I never have before, because I've been changing over the last year and I always do change. And always before, I'd always been a bit buttoned up about my faith because they don't share it, and that kind of thing. And somehow this has opened the door to my being completely honest with them and talking about childhood and talking about things like Dr. Morton, and which I talked about last time. And what was it this time? I don't know.
Can't remember.
We recalled two or three together, so I've got brain fade. And it's actually been an incredibly healing thing. So even if my mother, God bless her, if she stays alive happy, she should stay alive for as long as she wants.
Mm.
If she's not happy, I'd like her to go, thank you very much. But if she lives another 5 or 6 years and there's absolutely nothing left at the end of it, I'm still incredibly grateful because I've changed the relationship with my family.
Yeah.
How prosperous is that?
Yeah.
You know, I talked to my cousin about my mum when she was young and my aunt and how my dad was stolen by my mother, which you weren't, but he didn't know any of that stuff. And I was able to tell my cousin that my father admired him, and my cousin didn't know.
Oh, nice.
And he said, "Oh my God, I never knew why your father gave me his RAF wings." And I said, "My dad would never have given his RAF wings to anyone he didn't love and admire. They were his RAF wings, for God's sake." You know, and Joan go, "Oh, I just thought nobody else wanted them." And I went, "Don't be ridiculous."
Aww.
You know, but it comes back to all this thing about worth, and all my family never talked. But when I was starting to talk. So yay. Thank you, Mum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yes. Oh, the maybe this is one of the things that's coming out of these times as well as that particular situation, is that I hope that this conversation is interesting to a lot of people, because we are all, I think, or many of us, reassessing what our relationship is with prosperity, in that we're reassessing what it is we believe ourselves to want from our lives.
Yes.
I see that a lot. And that people are really, really realising that there's so much more to life than putting your nose to the grindstone, slaving away so that your children can go to the best school or be in the good catchment area or blah, 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 so that you can then retire, so that then you can look back from a place of safety.
Mm.
And I think a whole bunch of things have happened at once. First of all, we've realised that there's no safety in the place of safety and that nothing is certain.
Yeah.
And the second is that actually maybe there are other things we could be doing rather than just jamming our noses to the grindstone.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's been a reassessment of our relationship with the idea of what is important in a child's education also. Yeah. And what is it we are preparing them for by giving them that education?
Yes, parents all now know what their children are being taught.
Yeah.
And a lot of the parents are going, what the hell is a fronted adverbial? There's a fronted adverbial. Haven't we talked about this before? There was a whole thing about it going around Facebook about you had to teach children about a fronted adverbial. It's an adverb that goes in front of a verb. That's all.
Adverbial?
A fronted adverbial. And children have got to sort out fronted adverbials. No, it's just an adverb. I've got a friend who's a teacher who says basically it is just about passing the exams.
I know. I've repeatedly...
So maybe we're on a point of waking up. I wish we'd woken up an awful lot more. But some of us have woken up a bit more. And this last year with you has been pivotal in my life, in changing the way things for me. It's extraordinary. I really look forward to our conversation.
Well, me too. Yeah.
Good. And I talk on Zoom or Skype with my bishop every week. And we talk as friends.
Yeah.
And also he's giving my ongoing seminary training, because every year you have a week of ongoing training to teach you a little bit more. So we do that. But we're also discussing stuff and laughing about things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm talking with Tim, my adopted son in Cyprus, on far more than I ever did, because I don't know why, probably because we couldn't go and see him.
Well, and because you realise you actually enjoyed talking to each other. I remember you speaking about this in another thing. Yeah, that's really beautiful. Yeah, me too. I mean, I enjoy talking to you full stop, because I find our conversations interesting. But also there has been an element through this of someone who I can speak with deeply and who wants nothing from me other than that I be myself.
Yeah.
And that's been so precious. And it is, you know, that's one of the things I think we've realised as our conversations as a culture have become so weird, because they're Zoom or they're at 2 metres distance or whatever, is the importance of the preciousness of the people who will simply let us be who we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the most popular TV shows has been David Tennant and Michael Sheen zooming each other and bitching backwards and forwards and talking as actors. I've only seen a couple of them, but they're very open and honest, and they're acting. But it's lovely. Hopefully, we're beginning to open up to each other.
Yeah,
and we are finally understanding that 90% of people don't need to go to work every day. It can be done from home. And maybe we're understanding I think we will have an awful lot of mental health problems to deal with from the folk who was isolated.
I really hope we're understanding that whilst you don't necessarily need to go to work every day, your commute between your bedroom and your kitchen table might well be good for the company, but it's not good for your mental health.
No.
Unless you really are one of those people who absolutely loves their own company, treasures solitude, etc., etc. Yeah. It's great for the company that doesn't have to pay the electricity bill and the building rent and all that. But I am not convinced at all that it's super great for the individuals.
Mm.
But if work was only, I mean, let's be really radical, 3 days a week or something, and the other 4 we were able to socialise and see the people we love and go fishing or whatever it is that floats our boat, then maybe it would be completely sustainable to spend 3 days sitting at a bloody computer. Yeah. But and again, also, I think that the prevalence of comments around that kind of work is again just a reflection of the way in which these conversations are typically held by white middle class people, because there's a whole massive section of the company who did not get to sit on Zoom or anywhere else.
Yeah.
They had to collect the bins and go to work in the hospital and stack shelves in the supermarket and all the rest of it. And when are we going to live in a society where the jobs upon which it turns out our culture does actually depend
Are valued. Are
valued, paid a proper living wage, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why is it the people we need the most get the shittest pay? That's ridiculous.
Well, that's a good question. Why? Why? Why do we put up with this?
Yeah.
Why?
And I don't have an answer. Can you?
No. No. I can't answer.
But also, I think you say, why do we put up with it? I know that there are at least two answers to that. So a lot of nurses and teachers and, you know, people in those kind of professions would say that they're there because it's their vocation. And so they put up with it because it, the shit,
you know,
pay and shit conditions allows them to do their vocation.
Yeah.
And the people who are, you know, maybe being bin men and stacking shelves and all the rest of it would probably tell you, well, it's a job and it's better than the other option, which is no job.
Yeah.
And so they put up with it because they have to.
Yeah.
And so, again, that's me, okay? I've had to take a job in the co-op. I'm stacking shelves. Mm. Help me, Maggie. What can prosperity consciousness or what are you calling it? Because it's not prosperity consciousness.
Oh, God, I don't call it anything now because I don't actually teach it. I just do it when I can, you know, if somebody asks. Well, what do you do? Well, you start at the very beginning, which says that I'm not happy where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Okay. Is it true that you're not happy where you are? Right. Well, what's the common denominator about all the situations that you found yourself to be unhappy in? You.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it, the training or the thought processes that you are currently not aware that you're having, which are actually putting this out in your electromagnetic field that you are not worth more? Because mm-hmm. other people cannot disobey your electromagnetic field. If other people are working unconsciously, which most of us are, we just read each other. I mean, it's extraordinary how we do. I was doing a talk on prosperity many, many years ago to a group of people, and I was talking about what if you work with a difficult boss. And I said, just because Mr. Phillips is an absolute arsehole doesn't mean to say. And, of course, their boss was called Mr. Phillips, and they did think he was an absolute arsehole because I just picked it up out of their auric field.
Yeah.
And that's how it is. If you're going around going, I hate my bloody job and everybody is a bastard, it's quite difficult to get out because, well, how do I change it? And you start with simple affirmation. It really is. I love and value myself. And the first thing that's going to come up is, no, you don't, you're rubbish. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
If you think you're rubbish, why is anybody else going to think any different? Okay, you've been trained to think you're rubbish. It is not your fault. But now you've spotted it, it is your responsibility, your ability to respond. And you start off by rewiring one neural pathway in your brain. And that's the start point. Mm. And if you haven't got the discipline to do that, I really am sorry, but there's nothing else I can suggest at the moment. Mm. Because you've got to learn that discipline and say, I love and value myself.
I'm really liking that. I also believe there is a huge power to, I mean, this is such a crass thing to say. We all know there's a huge power to the notion that we co-create the universe by the way in which we experience it, because we experience it through our filters.
Yeah.
And so I want to add into the pot of I'm not happy stacking shelves in the co-op. I want to imagine a world where the people who are stacking shelves in the co-op are really happy to be there.
Yeah.
Because they're part of a great team and they're being paid
good money.
Good money, enough.
Yeah. And they're selling ethical products. And they're selling happy.
Ethical products. Yeah. And they like who they work with, and they like the fact that they can walk to work maybe, and they like the hours, it really suits them, and all the rest of it. And we don't all need to strive for, you know, I want to be who the hell other, you know, Miss World, whatever it is. But that perhaps we could put in the pot of our of all of our strivings for prosperity, whatever that means to us, that it's for everyone.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And the helping professions, that's such a tricky one, because so many people who are in the helping professions have only been taught to value themselves according to how they are valued by others. You're only of value if you're kind or good or doing this. And this has led us to what I actually call charity addiction, which is where people will run the marathon and post about it on Facebook because they, yes, they want to do good, absolutely, but they also need the people telling them they're good.
Mm.
It's not anonymous anymore. It's got to be, and, oh God, it sounds awful to say, look at me, I'm running a marathon for charity.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Because, and it's not anybody's fault, it's because that's the value we put on things. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at them, they're good, they're looking after somebody else.
Yeah.
But if they're not looking after themselves, then guess what? They're going to be asked to do more and more and more and more looking after the other. And when they're so bloody knackered they can't do it, the other will then turn on them. And the amount of times I see that, I've helped people and nobody helps me. And there's a mumble or a groan on social media. I do everything I possibly can, but when I reach out, does anybody show up? No, they don't. Not with that energy, they're not going to.
No.
Because you didn't take care of yourself. And it really comes down to a really firm discipline. Is where am I not showing the universe that I have value? And if you don't believe you have value, you've got to train yourself to start believing it.
Yeah. And not in a I'm showing you universe.
No.
But in a I'm realising universe that you made me and therefore I have value.
Yes. And that is one of the things that I do like about a good religion. Because you know you're of value to the Holy One. Even as Judas, even as a murderer, you are of value to the Holy One, because the whole purpose of creation is for God to experience manifestation, according to Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
So we are all little chips of God experiencing manifestation to evolve the whole process of everything, evolving stars, evolving everything. So every single aspect of everything is of value to God. And although it's been taught really badly, and I absolutely acknowledge that, it's still there. But so if you're atheist or agnostic, where do you find your intrinsic value if your parents can't give it you? It's not there, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's almost inconceivable to me to imagine a world where you have no... There are no spirits, there is no divine. Yes.
We are so blessed.
Yeah.
When I'm depressed or I'm down, I will go to my meditation chair and say, oh, I'm a bit screwed up at the moment, can you help?
Yeah. Is that the chair the beagle thinks it's hers?
Yes, beagle knows it's hers.
It might be.
There are days when I stand there where the beagles are fighting over my meditation chair.
I trust you fighting. Feel deeply calm and connected.
Oh, of course I do. A calm, assertive energy, and then I'll sit on the floor and meditate while there's a pile of beagles on the meditation chair. Because I'm a softer... Sometimes I'll throw them off the meditation chair.
No.
But yes, we are incredibly blessed. And the difficulty is, it's like a conspiracy theory in a way, because it's hard for us to start at the point where the people who need the help are starting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I own that. But I have been there. You know, it has been shit at times. And there have been so many times when, in Montana, I couldn't pay the rent on the cafe. I couldn't pay the rent of the building. And I just remember the utter humiliation of the landlord standing there shouting at me, this cannot go on, I'm closing you down. You know, and part of me going, I wish you would bloody close me down, you know. But what... the fear, the levels of fear that I have felt. And so I know that. And I know that if somebody who's a bit of a plonker like me, who doesn't even have a university degree, can get through it, somebody else can too. Have I told the story of my friend Rachel?
I don't know. Give me more
clues.
It's
a lady who was unemployed, single mother with a hurt foot.
No, don't think so.
She is... such a story of prosperity. It's extraordinary. She's a lovely girl anyway, and she came to study prosperity, bless her, and she did it. She had two children, single mother, living in a council house. She had to walk her children to school because she couldn't afford the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good half hour walking to the school, good half hour walking back, and then she'd have to go and meet them again in the afternoon. She was living on benefits, housing benefit. But what she wanted... to go to university. She didn't have any A-levels, any GCSEs, but she studied this work. She actually did the affirmations. And one day, God said to her, ring up the university. And she rang Birmingham University's theology department and said, I want to study re-up theology. And they said, who are you? What are you? And she said she'd got O-levels, but no A-levels. And there was a moment at the other end. They said, we're really down on admissions this year. Would you like to come in for an interview? And she got a place to study theology at Birmingham with no A-levels.
Yeah.
She is now a PhD. She's part of the retranslating of Codex Bezii. She's one of the top New Testament Greek scholars in the world. And she met a monk while she was studying, a Protestant monk, who demonked himself, and they got married.
No.
And they are living happily ever after.
Hurrah for them.
But, you know, she took the chance. She rang up a university with no A-levels and asked. You know, I was just, that woman just inspires me. And she's the one who taught me the meaning of the crucifixion, because she said it's not the suffering. The whole story of the crucifixion is not about Jesus hanging on the cross suffering, which the medieval folk really got into, the suffering of Jesus, because then they went into the original scene. It's not about that at all. It's about the dying. It's about the surrender to the problem, because the moment you surrender, resurrection is a done deal. Which is about letting go and...
Yeah, totally. So one of the wisest things anyone ever said to me, sadly, the woman who I thought said it to me claims that she didn't, but anyway.
Well, she channeled it probably.
She probably channeled it. But is the statement, all suffering is resistance.
Yes.
And that when you surrender to what is, and then think about, well, what's the next step? What can I do about what is? You start to head out of suffering.
Yeah, suffering is paralysis, isn't it? Yeah,
because you're stuck.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Deepak Chopra said something similar, and I've had a lot of people go, but it's true. He said, I'm not asking you to give up your pain. I'm asking you to give up your suffering.
Do you, originally, the word suffer simply meant to undergo?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we were talking earlier about the meanings of different words, because you were talking about your husband was looking at some old English, was it, or something?
Oh, yeah, he was. Why on earth was he looking up churl? I can't remember. Anyway, yes. Somebody had said, called someone churlish, and he was thinking, I'm sure I know something about churl. That means that churlish isn't a bad thing. Yeah. Yes, and it turned out that a churl is one of those words like a carl or a white or whatever. It's a man that it's a word that simply meant man, but it specifically means a man not of high rank. And so to be called churlish was therefore to be...
A snotty
put down for... Yeah.
But it meant a free man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I often go on about the fact that empatheia in Greek means to project your feelings onto somebody else. And now people are talking about empaths because we've changed the meaning of it.
Yeah.
And what people mean by empath right now is somebody who experiences the pain of the other. But that's a borderline thing, because actually, as we were saying last time, you can't experience the pain of the other. You can have great sympatheia, which means to have compassion for what you believe they're feeling, but you don't know what they're feeling.
Yeah, you can, I mean, you can feel their suffering, but you can't know the whys and the wherefores.
No, you can experience their suffering with them, and you can listen, absolutely, and that is what we would now call true empathy.
Yeah.
But quite a lot of people who do call them empaths, and I know some wonderful exceptions to this, absolutely, but I do come across people who are actually projecting their own suffering onto the suffering of the other.
Mm.
Oh, it's so terrible, and I know exactly how you feel because I've been through this too, you know, and that's not what empathy is meant to be. Empathy is meant to be, I am a vessel, I will hold you. But I'm a strong vessel.
Mm.
Tell me your grief.
Yeah.
And I will go, I hear you.
Because a trouble shared is a trouble halved.
Well, that is a very feminine thing. It's one of those men from Mars, women are from Venus, that strange book about men want to solve things, whereas women want to listen.
Yeah, share things.
And it's quite frequent, even now, after 20 happy years together, my husband will try and sort something for me. And I go, no, I just want to be heard.
Mm.
It'll sort itself. I just want to whinge.
Yes. The venerable art of whinging.
Yes.
Marvellous. Yeah, it's true, though. It's a strange thing, isn't it? But it's also, I mean, you know, let's not get started on that old chestnut of what we mean by when we're on about, well, it's a feminine thing to do or it's a masculine thing to do, whatever I do. The more I have any of these conversations, the more I believe we should be degendering all of it and talking about active and receptive.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I do try and say to people, before we start, do you want to be heard or do you want a solution?
Yeah.
Or do you want both?
Yeah.
Or a possible solution, you know. Do you want ideas for a solution or do you just want to be heard? And it's not just be heard. That's very valuable to be heard.
Yeah, it's very valuable to be heard. But, you know, that really does speak to the whole fundamental thing of trust. When we are heard, there are two really amazing things about being heard. The first is you get the opportunity to say it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And as you and I both know, sometimes we say something out loud and then we kind of look at it as this thing in the room that's been manifested by saying it out loud. Yes. And you go, oh, that's not right.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
But it rattles around in your head being what it is until you get to say it out loud.
Yes.
So in that respect, being heard is unbelievably valuable, so important. And then there's also this thing of somehow sometimes we get into separation, and when we get to be heard, as soon as you're heard, you're no longer in separation because other people know what's going on for you, and if they're holding you in that cauldron of love and support and you know, I can't make this go away for you, but I can
hold you in it.
Yeah, I can put my heart arms around you, even though I can't put my physical arms around you, and love you and know that you are suffering. And that makes an enormous difference. And there are some things that can't be fixed.
No, of course they can't.
And then also sometimes you say something and to the listener, the solution's fucking blindingly obvious.
Yes.
And you just hadn't thought of it.
Yeah. Oh, God, the amount of times that's happened to me is extraordinary. Yes. I always try and guide somebody when I am listening to talk about themselves. Because quite often I find, certainly in prosperity work, it gets into blame very quickly. They this, they that, they that. They've got everything. They should do this. They should sort that. No, let's talk about you.
Yeah.
How do you feel? Well, I hate them. Okay, you hate. Why do you hate? Where's the hate coming from? Tell me about the hate. Let's get that hate out. Mm. And quite often the hate isn't about them. It's projected to them. But the hate is self-hate.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important to pull people, but no, I want to hear about you.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here with you. How do you feel? And so often when you're listening to somebody, they'll go off and start talking about their husband. Or somebody else, no, I don't want to hear about your husband. Well, he's part of my life, I know, but I want to hear you talk about you.
Yeah.
Because this is actually avoidance.
I'm terrible for that. I won't talk about, it's bizarre actually, I tend not to talk about Fergus either, because I feel a great kind of a sense of never wanting to betray him, if you see what I mean, by speaking about him behind his back. Not that I would say bad things about him at all necessarily, but I don't know, it's a weird one. But I will so often, if a friend asks me how I am, start telling them about my kids' adventures. And like, not in a I'm giving away your secrets way, but just, I guess, because it's what's super important to me. But I realised recently, do you know what? You didn't answer the question. Somebody asked you how they were, you are, what's going on for you, and what was going on for you turned out to be
about your children.
All about my children. Yeah. And if my children, in the incredibly unlikely event that my children might be listening, I'm not giving away your secrets, my darlings, but they are what I think about a lot. Mm. And just to your wonderful woman who got into university with no A levels, my youngest son persevered and talked his way into university with no A levels.
Wow.
He didn't even, I think he had a GCSE in the appropriate subject.
Wow.
And just sheer bloody determination and hard work, and he got in.
Yeah.
And the other, likewise, managed to talk his way out of doing one subject and into doing another entirely at a different university. And just never give up. If you really, really, really want something, just never give up.
Go for it and simplify.
Yeah.
Just focus on the one thing. We've gone 39 minutes again, so may I close with another little story? This is a dream I had. I had a quarrel with one of my great spiritual teachers, and it was both our faults. We both wrong-footed. But I got a lot more blame because he was my spiritual teacher and I'd done something wrong. And I had a dream quite recently, and he had a sort of colleague who funded him and actually bought a house for him, who really hated me because he was very Jewish and I was a minister. And we don't need to go into the story, but put it this way, there was nothing I could do right for that guy, and I found him really difficult. They're both dead now, both these people. I had this dream in which my teacher was standing in a room and I was there with him, and he said, "Well done, you did okay." And I said, "Oh, thanks. In what way?" And he said, "You forgave me. That was the job. In this lifetime, that was the job that we had, was for me to wrong you and you to forgive me. I mean, you were culpable, but, you know."
Yeah.
And I went, "Oh, thanks, but I never forgave the other guy." And he said, "Yeah, well, that wasn't your job. That's not your job. That was not what you came here to do. That's a side issue." And that took away so much. Because I was thinking, well, I haven't forgiven the other guy. I've got to keep working on that. But I did the job. And I think that is sort of relevant, because what is the job? What do you want to do now? What do you want to achieve now? What do you want now? Stuff the others. What's the one job you can do now? And in prosperity, the one job you can do now is say 100 times when you wake up, "I love and value myself." And 100 times before you go to sleep, "I love and value myself." And if you won't do that, I won't work with you.
So just very quickly, because I know we're dicing with time again. For me, in shamanism, in whatever my work is, the question is always those questions also, but also focusing on, and what is the next step?
Yes.
There is this moment, there is the next moment, and in this moment you can choose how you step into the next moment. There is no point at end gaining. There's no point planning for your 5 million quid if you haven't bloody bought the ticket.
Yes, exactly. What can we do now? And then we're in a different situation, so what can we do now?
Yeah.
And then we're in a different situation. Inch by inch. But please start with "I love and value myself."
Yes.
And don't start it at 2 o'clock in the morning, because the negatives will win.
At 2 o'clock in the morning?
Yes, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the "I hate you, you won't, I don't love you, you're awful" will win. So don't ever do it at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is what I did once in Montana. At that point, get on the television and distract yourself until you can go back to sleep and start again in the morning. Mm. Yeah.
Right, so we should be quiet now.
We should be quiet
now. It's been far too long again.
No, it's not far too long, but it is long.
Okay.
God bless, thank you.
Lots of love.
Spirit bless. What would you say?
Many blessings, or, I don't know, lots of love, typically.
Yeah. See you next time.
Bye.